We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show, Hour 2. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Sears and Stanley Trollope. They are the authors of a popular series of detective novels set in Africa. Together, they write as a team. They write as Michael Stanley and have created a character, Detective David Bengu of the Botswana CID, Criminal Investigation Department. They have just published a third book in their series. It's just out. The title is Death of the Mantis, and their other titles include A Carrion Death and The Second Death of Good Luck Tinubu. They're here spending some time in Champaign-Urbana. In fact, they're on a book tour in the Midwest. They'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Champaign tonight at 7. So if you're interested in stopping by and meeting them, you can do that. And here this morning on the program, we'll talk about their writing and how it is that they got started and some of the things that they find attractive about this form. And if you have questions, you can call and talk with them. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Pleased to have your calls and pleased to have them here. And welcome. Thanks for being on the show here.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
I'm sure as we go along, we'll talk a little bit more about your backgrounds. Suffice to say that, Michael, you were born in South Africa and live in South Africa now?
Yes, I was born in Johannesburg, and I've traveled around the world quite a bit in my life, but I'm back in Johannesburg now, and that's where I live.
And Stanley, you were also born in Johannesburg, right?
Yes, I was born there, and now I sort of split my time between Minneapolis and a small coastal town near Cape Town called Knysna.
And you do have an important connection here to the University of Illinois.
Absolutely. I was in the Urbana-Champaign area from 71 till 83. I got my PhD here in education and then was on the faculty.
Yeah. So how is it the two of you just met, starting at that point?
Well, I think we met in South Africa first, but we actually got to know each other in Minneapolis. Because Stan was a professor at the University of Minnesota at that stage after he moved from here. And in that part of my life, I was a mathematician, and I used to come over to Minnesota to work with some faculty at the university there. I used to give up my South African summers and trade them in for Minnesota winters, which some people think was a bit strange. But anyway, we since we were both from South Africa, we got together. Stan invited me over. We had dinner together. We discovered we had lots of interests in common, of which traveling around Southern Africa was one of the major passions that we both shared. And Stan's a pilot, so he used to organize flying trips into different obscure parts of Southern Africa, and that's how we really got to know each other. Mm-hmm.
And was that something that helped to inspire the idea or get you onto the idea of writing together?
Yes. One of the trips that we went into Botswana, into an area called Savuti, which is part of a huge national park, we saw a pack of hyenas attack and demolish a wildebeest. And hyenas eat everything of an animal, including the bones. So after they finish, there's basically nothing left. And we thought, what a great way to get rid of a body.
As one does.
Well, of course. Yeah. Of course, that would be the natural thing that you would think.
Exactly.
What a good way to dispose of a body.
And so that was an idea that sort of lingered in our heads from the mid-80s until until when I retired in 2003.
Mm-hmm. So, and that is one of the features of a carrion death, right? That idea that someone commits a murder and they decide that that's the perfect way to get rid of the body.
Right. That's the opening scene, and they discover the body before it's been completely removed by the scavengers, the hyenas in particular. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a very long story to follow it. Mm-hmm. And And then, of course, the question arises for the police, why was it so important that this body was completely removed and that there are no traces, the fingerprints have been destroyed and so on, so that there's no possibility of finding out who the person was.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the appeals of the mystery novel or the detective story, whatever you want to call it, is that it's very portable. You can take it and you can go anywhere with it. And of course, if you go down to the bookstore, you go down to the library, you see mysteries that are set virtually every place in the world at almost every time. There's mysteries in ancient Egypt. There's mysteries in the Middle Ages. There's mysteries in the Norse countries. There's mysteries in East Asia. There's mysteries everywhere. I mean, it seems to be a very durable form that people all over have done things with. Was that just for you part of the appeal? The idea was, well, maybe there were some things that you wanted to write about and it would allow you to do that?
I think that having the idea of the body and the hyenas sparked our interest. Mm-hmm. And once we started writing, I think we started looking more closely at some of the underlying stories. The hyena not finishing a body is a good start to a novel, but it's insufficient to keep a novel going. Mm-hmm. And all our books, the three that are published, the one that we're writing now, have as an understory, a backstory, a contemporary issue in Botswana. The first one is really Blood Diamonds. The second one are the after effects of the Rhodesian Civil War and the illegal immigration between the two countries. This one is the issues surrounding the Bushmen, mm-hmm. and the one we're writing is another real issue in Africa, Southern Africa, and that is the use of human body parts for magic potions.
As I said, I think that's I'm sure what a lot of people would find would be the appeal of this form, is that you can tell a good story, and you must, or else people aren't one must, or else people aren't going to read the book. But it does give you the framework to say something about some problem in human relations, some particular set of people, their culture, their time, you know, what their challenges are. And I think it's interesting that you've really set out to do that and spent a lot of time doing that very thing.
Yes, I think we really enjoy Botswana as a country. We enjoy the people. It's diverse both in terms of culture and in terms of geography, ranging from the Kalahari Desert in the southwest where the new book Death of the Mantis is set, right up to the lush riverine forest full of elephants and other animals up on the border with Zimbabwe. So we've been told that in a sense the country is a character in its own right. But I think what you're really getting at is that there are different social and cultural issues, shall we say, as well as external issues, as Stan has mentioned, which determine the details. The canvas is the mystery story, but the actual painting depends very much on where it's set and what one can display by doing that.
And I know from having read some things that you have said about your writing is that you're particularly interested in, I think, telling the story of Africa now, and perhaps countering some of the images that people have about what kind of a place Africa is.
Yeah, we are very proud, I think, to be from Africa and love Africa. And certainly there are bad things that happen in Africa, but there are certainly bad things that happen in many other places. And having lived in this country for many years, I know very strongly how people have a misconception of Africa. Sometimes I've had to drag some of my friends from the States over to South Africa, and when they get there and have spent 2 or 3 weeks there, they are astounded that it is such a beautiful place, so modern, in some ways more modern than some of the things in this country. Mm-hmm. And they never ever realized that before. And we hope that in some way through our writing we can interest people to visit Africa, because it's a fascinating and beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure that probably for a lot of people, when they think of South Africa, they can't get all of the troubles associated with apartheid out of their heads. That's what they're going to think about.
And certainly there are troubles that have resulted, even though the current government has been in power for 15, 16 years. There are parts of South Africa that are very dangerous. There's no doubt about it. But as with anywhere else, if one is prudent, you can have a terrific time. I have women friends in Johannesburg who drive around, walk around, jog by themselves, and have a very normal life.
Let me introduce again, just very quickly, our guests, Michael Sears and Stanley Trollope. They write together as Michael Stanley and have written three mystery novels set in Botswana, and they're all involving a man who is has the nickname Kubu. David Bingu is his name. He's a policeman in the Botswana Criminal Investigation Department. Their new book, which is the third one, it's just out. It's titled Death of the Mantis. And if you like that, then there are two others as well that you can look at. Or if you are like me and you like to read them in order, you want to start with the very first one and work your way through. And you can find them all in the bookstore. And as I mentioned at the beginning, they'll be making an appearance at the Barnes & Noble in Champaign tonight at 7. So you can stop by and say hello. And questions here are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, give us a little introduction to your main character here, David Bingu. Tell us about him.
Well, as you've mentioned, his nickname is Kubu, and Kubu is the Setswana word for hippo. So that in itself should give the listeners some feeling of what he's like. He's a very large man. He enjoys his food and his wine a little bit too much, perhaps. But he also shares some other hippo characteristics. He's very focused on what he wants to do, and if you get between him and his objective, that's not a good scenario. And most people know that if you're in the African bush and you're between the hippo and deep water, then that's not a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. So Kubu shares those sort of characteristics, and he got this nickname from a school friend who spotted both the similarities in terms of size and in terms of mindset. Mm.
The hippo is generally regarded, other than the mosquito, as being the most dangerous animal in Africa.
See, this is very interesting, and one of the things that you would read, you would learn by reading, because I'm sure that most people would think, well, okay, a hippopotamus is really big. And most of the time when you see them, they appear to be lounging. You know, the idea that something that big could get up a head of steam and do it very quickly and run you down before you knew what was going on, that I'm sure a lot of people would find that very surprising.
Yes. Go ahead.
Yes, that may be. And African rivers, of course, are dangerous not only because of hippos but because of crocodiles. But I think people probably do have more concern about crocodiles and alligators. And on the whole, you're right. Hippos are pretty phlegmatic, and they take their leisure on sandbanks and sun themselves, or they lie in deep water, and you just see an occasional little snort come up. There's a South African expression called the ears of the hippo, which is like the tip of the iceberg. If you just see the ears sticking over the water, they're very much relaxed. It's really more if they feel threatened or if they feel that you're, as I say, trying to block them from their safe environment, which is deep water.
What a lot of people don't understand or realize, particularly people from overseas, is that hippos feed on land at night and can cover 3, 4, 5 miles at night as they eat. And running into a hippo at night on the land is one of the most dangerous situations, because they take fright, and you probably take a big fright as well. Mm-hmm. And their mouths are huge. A very large hippo with its mouth wide open, probably an ordinary person could stand in it.
Really? Seriously?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I'll be careful. If I see any hippos on my way to lunch, I'm going to be very careful. When you create a story like this, I think it's expected that you're going to have a character that is singular, and all detectives have their eccentricities. I suppose if there wasn't something about them that made them interesting, again, we wouldn't read these books. And so here we have a character that is literally a very outsized, a big person in all ways. And I just wonder, you know, was there some particular place where the inspiration of the character came from? Was there a particular moment when you say, I closed my eyes and I saw this man standing in front of me? Something as dramatic as that?
Well, it's actually quite interesting. We did set out with the first book to make Kubu the main character. We talked about the hyena and the body being discovered, and the body was discovered by a game ranger with an ecologist. And an ecologist, coincidentally, who had been trained at the University of Minnesota. You're always told when you start writing that you should write about things that you know about. Mm-hmm. So since we've both been university professors in our time and know a little bit about ecology, we thought that would be a good character. And I think it's an interesting character. But, of course, when a body is discovered, the next thing that happens is the police have to be called. And so we knew there were going to have to be police and a policeman investigating the death. And so we created a policeman. How did we create the policeman? Well, this policeman left his office at the CID. He clambered into his Land Rover, had his sandwiches with him, switched on his music, and took off into the Kalahari. And there he was. So there was no plotting of what he was going to look like. There was no real thought about it. He was just there. And by the time he reached the camp where the body had been discovered, he'd taken over the plot. He'd shouldered the ecologist out of the way, said, you're just a subsidiary character. You're going to be interviewed, and you can have a little bit of a side story with a witch doctor if you like, but I'm running the show here. Yeah, and that was it. So there was no sudden inspiration. He just seemed to be there.
It's remarkable how characters can do that. I know authors say that over and over again. I don't know if people really understand how that can happen, but it does. It clearly does. Mm-hmm. And he's a man of appetites, of large appetites, as you say. He likes good food. He likes wine. He likes opera. He's an opera lover.
He's a very poor singer. and I think, as with, well, I'm also a very poor singer, and I do enjoy belting out songs every now and again, but almost always in private. Mm-hmm. And so he enjoys the long trips in Botswana. It's a huge country. You can drive for hours and hours and hours and not even see anybody else. And so he enjoys that time to be an opera singer, very good in his own mind.
We've got a pact in the car that when it comes to opera singing, we listen to the appropriate public radio station.
I see. Let them do the singing.
Exactly.
Exactly. I was interested in one of the interviews that I read, that you get a print interview where you were talking about your writing and about the character that I think it was Michael says that you saw Kubu as a hardworking policeman, but one who also believes in the traditional family values of Botswana. Meaning what?
Well, in the sense that he's a modern person, that he deals with crimes in a modern way, and that he certainly sees himself as a modern Western type of person, and yet he's very close to his family. His family are traditional. They live in the same small village where he was born. His father is a herbalist who grows plants for medicinal purposes, not a witch doctor type of person, but a healing type of person. His mother believes in the appropriate Setswana cultural aspects, such as, why are you not married? And how long am I going to have to wait for this? And when are the grandchildren coming? And so on. You might say, well, that's not entirely restricted to the Setswana culture, but that's certainly one of the aspects. So his parents are very traditional. He's sort of they're poor. They're not. He doesn't come from a rich family. In Botswana, education is free if you qualify for it. So there's not a barrier on the basis of what your parents can and can't pay. And he was able to obtain an education that way. So he still has one foot in the camp of being culturally traditional, shall we say. Mm.
And in this particular book, In Death of the Mantis, he is married, and he and his wife have just had a baby. So he's trying to sort out his obligations to his family and how you balance that with his obligations to his job.
And as with many people, that's a difficult thing to do for him. He's not the most responsive person sometimes to the needs of either his wife or child, especially at 1 or 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I think his wife, Joy, decides that it's far easier to deal with the child than to try and get Kubu awake and moving.
Mm. Not the first wife, I'm sure, finding herself in a position like that. Let's talk some more about the country, because as you mentioned there at the beginning, that you grew up in and live in South Africa, and yet the book is not set in South Africa. It's set in the country that's just right north of there. Something about the potential of that place as a story setting that you found particularly appealing?
Yes, I think originally the catalyst, if you like, for setting the first book in Botswana was simply this idea that the body was going to be dumped out in an area where there were predators and scavengers which would destroy it. That's not easy to do in South Africa. South Africa's much more developed from that point of view. If you were to go to the Kruger National Park, for example, you'd be going through a number of security gates, you'd be signing in, you'd be signing out, and sort of saying, well, what's the purpose of your trip? Well, I've come to dump a body for hyenas to eat. Isn't really going to go down too well with the authorities there. Whereas Botswana is much less populated, much more open. There's much less control, less fences, and that sort of scenario is quite possible. We'd originally thought of perhaps setting it in the Kalahari Game Reserve in South Africa, but the same things that I just mentioned apply there. So then we went a bit further north. That was the immediate reason. I think the second reason is we just like Botswana so much. We like the people there. It seemed to have all sorts of different aspects that one could display in a series of books. And once we started writing there, we spent time doing things in Botswana that we hadn't done before, such as spending time with the Commission of Police and with the head of the CID. And we enjoyed their company a lot. They were very helpful. They were very kind to us. They were busy people who made time to chat to authors, or in fact potential authors, as we were at that stage. So we just felt very comfortable with the scenario there.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds like it's a. In, as you have said, one of the interesting things about the country is that there's terrific variety in the terrain, so you have different opportunity of different backdrops, but that there's also a lot of wild country where there aren't a lot of people. And it sort of puts me in mind of something that Sherlock Holmes says to Watson at some point, where he talks about crime in the countryside. And he says something like that it's much more dangerous than in the most dangerous part of London, because there's nobody around and nobody is watching over your shoulder. Nobody can see what you do. And it's possible to get away with a lot of things if there's nobody around that you're not going to be able to do in the middle of London.
Botswana is one of the least densely populated countries in the world. It's very big, and it has less than 2 million people in the entire country.
Hmm. Stanley mentioned, I think, this book, The Death of the Mantis, one of the themes, the subjects that runs through here is the life of the indigenous people, the Bushmen, who have been there living as they do for who knows how long. And so part of what you learn in reading the book is you read something about what their what their life is like, what their values are like, and the difficulty that they are facing in trying to maintain their culture in the face of change, you know, in inevitable change. And this is something that you must have been thinking about for some time, because in the very first book, you introduced this idea that Khubu has this kind of connection, and there is this character that then comes back and is very important in Death of a Mantis. What made you want to write about the Bushmen?
The Bushmen are fascinating. Genetic studies recently have shown that virtually, in fact, all of the people on the planet originate from the border of Namibia and Angola, which is just next to Botswana. And it is generally held that the Bushmen are probably the group from which all other current humans originated. They've been around for tens of thousands of years. They are now in the Kalahari because they have been squeezed there from the north by black groups and from the south by white groups. And they have sort of retreated into the desert because it is so inhospitable, and have developed a lifestyle, if you like, that allows them to survive there. That being said, there are very few traditional Bushmen left. They have been squeezed to such an extent that we don't know how many are operating, living in the traditional way, but it's very, very few. Probably in the hundreds now, not thousands. Mm. And there are so many things about the Bushman culture that are very appealing. In many ways, very similar to the Native American culture. They don't regard the earth as belonging to anybody. The earth is for everybody. If they're in the desert and they come across food or water, they would never finish it, because they would say there may be another group coming on after us and they will need sustenance. So it's a very sharing culture, very oriented to survival without any destruction of where they are. And all of that's appealing. And then, of course, there are other things like the Bushman poisons. For anybody who's interested this evening at the Barnes & Noble, I don't know how long ago, 40, 50 years ago, I acquired an authentic hunting kit of Bushmen. And in this leather quiver, or this leather bag, if you like, are the entire belongings of a Bushman. And it's just fascinating to have a look at them. The bow, the arrows, how the arrows work, the musical instruments that they carried. And so everything about them is just fascinating. Mm.
And a lot of that you will be able to learn also in, if you read the book, Death of the Mantis.
Yes, one of the issues that's in the backstory of the book is the situation with the politics around the Bushman people, and probably some of the listeners will have been following this. The Bushmen have been in the Kalahari for a very long time, as Stan pointed out, but the Kalahari Game Reserve, the Central Kalahari Game Reserve, as it's now called, is a declared game reserve, and recently the government has been trying to move the Bushmen out of the area. And the reasons they give are, first of all, that it's a wildlife preserve now, and the Bushmen's natural nomadic behavior is to hunt as well as hunting gathering. But the main issue, at least as far as the government states it, is that the Constitution guarantees certain basic services to every citizen in the country, and the government takes the Constitution very seriously. For example, every child is supposed to be within walking distance of school. They should be able to walk to a school. Well, if you're a nomadic people and you're moving from one place to another, then clearly you're not in walking distance of a school, and indeed the children are probably not going to school at all. So that is a concern, and there's similar issues with healthcare and so on. On the other hand, the Bushman people say, well, this is just to try and get us out of the area because well, I should say some of the Bushmen people claim that this is to get them out of the area because the government wants to do other things with it, such as develop it for tourism. There have been suggestions of diamond mines being discovered in the area and so on. And this led to a conflict between some of the Bushmen groups with the support of Survival International and with the government. And that led to a high court case, and just recently that's been resolved in the favour of the Bushmen. But the problems still remain. You don't usually resolve cultural issues in court.
We're talking this morning on Focus with mystery writers Michael Sears and Stanley Trollope. Together they write as Michael Stanley. They've written three novels set in Botswana. The newest one is Death of the Mantis. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, former FBI agent Ali Soufan talks about his experiences interrogating Islamist terrorists. He got Abu Zubaydah to identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of 9/11. But then the interrogation was taken over by the CIA and Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded. Soufan's new book is called The Black Banners. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Village of Savoy, hosting Savoy Orchard Days this Friday and Saturday, September 16th and 17th, with activities for the whole family, like carnival games, music, food, a beer tent, a 5K run, tractor pull, and an antique car and truck show. A schedule of activities is online at village.savoy.il.us.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. Let me just mention tomorrow, we've actually managed to get here back-to-back two programs where we're talking with writers. Tomorrow in our 11 o'clock hour, I will talk with Rolando Hinojosa. He's a novelist, essayist, poet. He's a professor of English at the University of Texas. He's written a whole series of novels about a county in South Texas on the border that he has invented, a place called Belkin County, and some of them are police procedurals. So we'll talk all about that, about his writing tomorrow. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He will be in the studio with me. As I say, we're here weekday mornings with 10 topics. You can go to our website and find out what we'll do here in the future. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, I am talking with Michael Sears and Stanley Trollope. Together, they write as a team. They've written three mystery novels set in Botswana, in Africa. They write as Michael Stanley, and their newest book is titled Death of the Mantis, all about the detective that we mentioned, the detective whose nickname is Kubu, which is the word in Setswana for hippopotamus. The book's published by Harper, and it is out now. And as I mentioned, they'll be here. They are here to do an appearance. They'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Champaign tonight at 7 o'clock. You can stop by and meet them. Michael Sears was born in Johannesburg. He grew up in Cape Town and then also in Kenya. He studied mathematics. He worked for Anglo American, which is a big mining house, worked in the area of remote sensing. Stanley Trollope was born in Johannesburg, and he went to school here at the University of Illinois, got his PhD here in 1970 in educational psychology, and has taught various places. He still lives part of the year in South Africa and then also part of the year in
Minneapolis.
Michael lives all the time in South Africa, and we're pleased that they could be here. They're traveling around, spending some time various places around the Midwest to talk about their writing, and we're happy to have them here. Questions are welcome. In fact, I have an email question here, and somebody on a phone we will do. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's the caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Ah, good morning. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've read the three books so far and greatly anticipating any more that's forthcoming. They're wonderful stories, and the setting is magnificent. So I have a couple of questions. One is, perhaps the guests could talk about their influences in terms of writing mysteries, and the other is whether there has been any prospect of movies or television programs based on this, because the settings that they create are just so dramatic, and I think would really lend themselves to that.
No. Yeah.
In terms of influences, I certainly have been an avid reader all my life, and have read all types of genres, but within the genre of mystery, I have always sort of leant towards mysteries with a cultural background. So, for example, one of my favorite authors is Tony Hillerman, who is no longer with us, but he focused all his mysteries in the Southwest, and his protagonist was a Navajo detective. So that is the sort of style that I've always had an interest in, people like P.D. James, whether the pace is a little slower than some of the hard-boiled American writers, perhaps. And so that's how I've been influenced.
Yes, I think we probably have similar reading habits, just as we have similar writing habits. Certainly P.D. James has always been one of my favorite authors, and I do like the aspect of a crime novel or a mystery novel where you're trying to outguess the detective or outguess the writer and come up with a solution earlier than you're supposed to. So there's a bit of a puzzle-solving thing in it for me. Apart from that, I very much enjoy the novels of John le Carré. And that's a different sort of genre, but the way in which he develops characters and the way in which he gets the narration moving, I think, is very interesting. I think one tries not to copy anyone when one's writing. In fact, sometimes it's a worry. You're reading something and you think, well, is this somehow going to distill itself into what I'm writing at the same time? But certainly all these things are in the background and are there one way or the other.
What about the possibility of some kind of screen adaptation of your books?
Well, we would love that, of course, but we haven't had any approaches yet.
No one's approached you yet. Well, perhaps based on the success of the number one ladies detective agency, there would be some interest. And I imagine that now probably anybody, I know that there are a lot of very good crime writers, a lot of very good African crime writers. I suppose everybody is in the shadow, kind of in the shadow of Alexander McCall Smith, because of the amount of attention that he's gotten for his books.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, for us, obviously, writing in Botswana, it's a very close relationship. I must say, we actually hadn't heard of Alexander McCall Smith when we started writing the first book.
Poor Alexander said, no, I hadn't heard of this guy.
Right. I'm sure that's hard for many people to believe, but it was actually true. And when we did, we considered, should we move the book somewhere else? I think for the reasons that we discussed earlier on, we didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And also, Botswana is a country the size of France, so I think it's big enough to support two writers. And Sandy McCall Smith's books are very different from ours. Ours are very much crime stories. People have said to us the only thing in common is the setting, actually, mm-hmm. rather than the style or the structure of the books. So I mean, we certainly see it as a help in the sense that we don't get people asking us where Botswana is. They've probably got a connection already through reading the number one ladies detective agency series.
Yeah, I like the idea that Kubu could be walking down the street and pass Ramat's way, going the other way.
I have to say that on occasion, probably with a glass of wine in hand, we considered having them marry each other.
I think she's already married. That might be a bit of a problem. But I did think it was funny at the end of Death of the Mantis, where Kubo's come through this very difficult case, and he's considering actually quitting, giving up the job, and his boss says to him something like, well, now what would you do? Really go out and start the number one man's detective agency? I like that a lot. Something that I read that I thought was really nice in one review that I read, I think actually it was a review of your first book, that the reviewer writes about, he said, writes, while the investigation moves along at a rapid clip, there is a wonderful feeling of slowing, of consideration, of reflection whenever Kubu appears in the narrative. Something about the writing of the character that imparts a feeling of consideration, intelligence, and thoughtfulness. And I thought that was very nice. I'm sure one would be pleased to have somebody say that about your character. And I think, though, that also says something about pacing and about the feel of the story and the sort of the way things move along, and whether that's something that you feel that you've, in some deliberate way, you're trying to cultivate.
I think it's very deliberate. Africa is a slower place, mm-hmm. and things don't happen bang, 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 just like that. People do things a little bit more slowly. They do balance work with play, I think, better than in the United States. And so Kubu's character, where he visits his parents every Sunday and spends time with his wife Joy, is a very African thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I think we like that, not only because it depicts Africa, but because it provides a contrast within the book of hopefully pace when there's the investigation of the crime, and then there's a pullback as he deals with his family and other things. Sort of a little bit, you know, Shakespeare used to do this the whole time. He would, in his big tragedies, there was always humor. There was always a juxtapositioning of different things. And I think it was very purposeful on our behalf.
Yeah. I think, though, it is certainly true that there is a point, and for me, I think that's a mark of how engaged I am in the story. There's a point where the story gains so much momentum that it grabs you, and you say, "Okay, I can't do anything else now. what's going to happen here?" Where you really want to keep turning the pages, and to me, I'd say, well, that's a sign of a good story, that it gets to a point where you get caught up in it so much that you just have to know where it's going to go.
The other thing that we've tried to do with Kubu, and you mentioned this, is this idea of reflection. Mm-hmm. And we try to get inside his head on occasion, not only to reflect about the case, but we try to have other observations that he makes that may be unrelated to the case, but they're sort of fleeting observations. And we think that that is sort of part of his character, that he's not just a detective. He's a person who's very aware of what's going on around him. He comments on, you know, the perpetual presence of animals on the roads. All of those are going through his head the whole time. And to some extent, we try to show those to round him out as a character.
I want to make sure that I mentioned this email because it was also a question that I definitely wanted to ask. And we have someone here who writes in and says that she and her husband have been thinking about writing a novel together, but have had difficulties trying to figure out how to collaborate on it. And was interested in having you talk about how you decide as you write together about who writes what and how you make this collaborative process work.
Yes, that's an interesting question. We've discovered since we started writing together, and when we started writing, it was the first time either of us had written fiction seriously together, so we were learning an awful lot of things, including how to write together. It was only subsequently that people sort of said to us, well, you know, it's very unusual for people to write fiction together. It's very common to write nonfiction together. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, we've met and discovered quite a few pairs of writers writing usually under one name, and they seem to do things in different ways. So there probably isn't a right way or a wrong way to do it. There's probably the way that works for the team. We do everything together. Basically, we do the writing. We do the plotting. That's not to say that when we write every other word or something like that. But it's not a situation where one of us does the plot, one of us writes the narrative, one of us writes one character, and so on. We try and get together and design the plot, do the framework, the canvas, as I said earlier, on which we're going to develop the story. And chat about some of the characters that are going to come up and so on. And then what we'll do is we'll take a particular section of the story, perhaps two consecutive chapters or perhaps two consecutive parts that are developing, and one of us will write the first draft of the one, and the other will write the first draft of the second part. And then when we've done that first draft, as you've mentioned, you know, we're usually far apart. Stan is in Minneapolis or in Knysna. Even Knysna's 1,200 kilometers away from Johannesburg, so not close. So when we've done the writing, we swap it over by email, and then the other person will pick up the writing from the first draft.
And then I'll look at what Michael has written and edit it. And I'll like certain parts, and I'll suggest changes to other parts, and some parts may be just terrible, so I'll slash my red pen across them. And once I've finished that, I'll just send it right back to him for his consideration.
And then I get this back, and I think he's cut out these brilliant insights that I developed in this chapter that I lay awake at night constructing. And he's replaced it by no or yes, as the case may be. So I read through it, and I think we've worked together long enough and we're good enough friends that when we have one of these experiences, our first thought may be, ah, but then it follows into, yes, he's right, that was pretentious, that was too long, that did slow things down. That doesn't mean to say that I'll accept everything. Some of the things I will reword again. One of the great things about writing together, and for your for the questioner, it's something to think about, is you always have somebody who's really keen to see what you've written, to read it, and to give real feedback. Not of the good friend type of feedback, which was, yes, I read what you wrote. I really liked it. You know, you should carry on. That doesn't really help you. It may encourage you, but it doesn't help to make things better. So we've got that very strong connection, and we really enjoy working that way.
One comment I'd like to make to the questioner is that if you are going to work with somebody, whether it's your spouse or a friend or somebody else, the collaboration generally is only productive if you can have an incredibly thick skin. You've got to be able to take really honest criticism without taking it personally, and you need to be able to give a similar criticism to the other person without that other person attacking you either physically or some other way.
Well, this the fact that you're still speaking, I'd say that says a lot about your friendship. The fact that through now three novels and you're working on a fourth, that you have managed to work out a way to do this.
The worst that happens is we can have a disagreement over something, and it can get quite acrimonious. But ultimately, we regard them as heated agreements because we actually want the same thing. Mm-hmm. And even though we may shout at each other a little bit, ultimately, it's for the same purpose, and we end up with something that we can both agree with.
Well, are there particular things that you would say one of you is better at?
Well, I mean, I think there are areas where one of us knows more than the other. For example, in the first book with the diamond back theme, the blood diamond backstory, because I worked for Anglo American for 10 years, and Anglo is the parent company of De Beers, I know quite a bit about that aspect of it. Stan, on the other hand, is a pilot, as we mentioned, so when it comes to flying and issues of that nature. So that's how we choose who do the first draft.
Mm. We're coming down to just a couple of minutes left for anybody who's tuned in. I want to make sure you know that you are listening to Michael Sears, Stanley Trollope. They're mystery writers. Together they write as a team as Michael Stanley, and they have produced now three novels set in Africa. The most recent is Death of the Mantis, and they're working on a fourth, and they're here visiting in the area and will be making an appearance at the Barnes & Noble tonight at 7. So if you'd like to meet them, you can stop by. And if somebody wanted to call real quick, we could probably get in a question. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about, now I have read just a little bit about the new book, the book that you're working on now, and that it has to do, that each, you explain each novel sort of revolves around something that's an issue in Africa This one has to do with the use of human body parts in magic.
Yes. One of the things that we've found is that a lot of people in this country, the U.S., don't really understand the role of, I'll use the word witch doctor. It conjures up perhaps an incorrect picture. But there are many people in Africa who are traditional healers who don't necessarily use Western medicine. And a very, very small number of those go beyond the pale and will try to help people do things. So if, for example, a politician wants success or a man wants greater sexual prowess, some witch doctors will find a human who has an attribute that this other person wants and kill that person and take that attribute, whatever it is, create a potion, if you like, and give it to the end recipient. It's widespread. It doesn't happen every day, but it certainly happens more often than anybody would like it to happen. And very often the recipients are people who have money, hence politicians, police, businessmen, and very often investigations into these things get suppressed because they would finger people in who have influence and position.
Mm. All right. So this is you're hoping to keep this this series going for now. You will be a fourth book, and presumably as long as you can continue working, you'd like to keep doing this.
Yes, we've already got an idea for the fifth book. We won't go into it now because it's just a twinkle in the eye, so to speak. But we do it because we enjoy it so much, and some people seem to really like our books. So as long as we enjoy it and people enjoy reading the books, we'll carry on.
All right, very good. Well, there we will have to leave it as we've here come to the end of the time. I will mention one more time that if you would like to meet our guests, Michael Sears and Stanley Trollope, they will be making an appearance at the Barnes & Noble in Champaign tonight at 7 o'clock. They're here spending some time traveling around the Midwest, making some appearances, and we're pleased to have them here. Michael Stanley, and the new book is Death of the Mantis. It's published by Harper. Thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We've enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. That this other person wants, and kill that person, and take that attribute, whatever it is, create a potion, if you like, and give it to the end recipient. It's widespread. It doesn't happen every day, but it certainly happens more often than anybody would like it to happen. And very often the recipients are people who have money, hence politicians, police, businessmen, and very often investigations into these things get suppressed because they would finger people in who have influence and position.
Mm. All right. So this is you're hoping to keep this this series going for now. You will be a fourth book, and presumably, as long as you can continue working, you'd like to keep doing this.
Yes, we've already got an idea for the fifth book. We won't go into it now because it's just a twinkle in the eye, so to speak. But we do it because we enjoy it so much, and some people seem to really like our books. So as long as we enjoy it and people enjoy reading the books, we'll carry on.
All right, very good. Well, there we will have to leave it as we've here come to the end of the time. I will mention one more time that if you would like to meet our guests, Michael Sears and Stanley Trollope, they will be making an appearance at the Barnes & Noble in Champaign tonight at 7 o'clock. They're here spending some time traveling around the Midwest, making some appearances, and we're pleased to have them here. Michael Stanley, and the new book is Death of the Mantis. It's published by Harper. Thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We've enjoyed it.
Thanks so much.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And that's it for us here on Focus. Coming up next, we'll have the Afternoon Magazine. We'll be beginning here getting you an update on the commodity markets. And I think for that, we're going to go to Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Dave, and good afternoon, everyone. U.S. grain futures are tumbling on the Chicago Board of Trade today, with corn down more than 3% as crop conditions in the U.S. improved off of yesterday afternoon's NAS report. Nationally, crop conditions showing a 1% improvement, as well as technical selling accelerating the decline and follow-through selling pressure we see off of yesterday's USDA crop production and WASD reports. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. We'll begin in Kansas City, where September wheat is now at 777, down 26. The March 819, down 21 and a quarter. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 684 and a half, down 15 and a quarter. December 703 and three quarters, down 23 and a quarter, now down 23.